When you're putting together a career path, you don't necessarily have to leave one employer for another in order to advance. At least that's what this week's career coach tells Techonomics host Jason Middleton. After that career negotiation conversation, we look at this week's tech headlines, including iconic retailers taking it on the chin. First, a career pep talk.
Hello and welcome back, and thanks for giving Techonomics a listen. This week's closing segment is a twofer. We are going to unpack what went down at the Federal Reserve this week and why it matters for your mortgage. But first, we need to pay off on Tad Mayer. He's a career negotiator and coach, and his advice on job interviews is solid. He has a tip that ranks as the best one I've ever heard for how to answer this typical interview question. Do you have any questions for me? Here's part two of my chat with author, career coach, and crazy good job tipster, Tad Mayer. Sounds like both are not just like we discussed at the top, the informational interview, but that data is very, very valuable, but not easy to get. Do you stalk people on LinkedIn who used to work at a company and try to find out something from them and maybe private message them?
Sure. I mean, there are all kinds of ways to get in touch with people. What really matters is what you say. So it can be a LinkedIn message. You know, even better if it's a personal referral from someone and it's an email or a call. But it can be any sort of contact. But what matters is when you make that contact, what do you say? And what is essential is to look into their background, figure out what drives them, what motivations they have, and then address that in your cover email saying you'd like to meet with them so that it's not just you pulling information from them. It's not just what you can get. It's about creating a transaction where you're both an exchange of value and information. And so if you look through their, let's say you look through their LinkedIn profile and you see that they're a member of a nonprofit, and let's say it's for raising money for running a marathon. And let's say you've run a marathon. You can offer in your cover email, you know, I've run the Boston Marathon and we've raised money. Would it be helpful if I shared the best practices that our team has used to raise money? Because then you're asking for the informational interview, but you're bringing something of value, and that's going to capture their interest.
That's really good advice, and that's very clear. Thank you for that. And Ted, I have to say, your bona fides are long. I mean, we're looking at Dartmouth and Northwestern. Your client list is all tier one companies. I have to ask, you've been talking the talk. Have you had to walk this walk yourself when it comes to negotiating a career?
Yes, I have, because I've chosen to pivot a few times. And so I've had to dig, you know, gain that information and build those relationships many times. And, you know, most recently when I was getting into being a career coach, I wanted to learn more about the world of outplacement. And those are services when people are laid off. There are firms that help those people find new jobs more quickly. And a colleague of mine knew someone in outplacement, so I did an informational interview with that person. And as I was going through their company bio and blogs that they'd written and their LinkedIn profile, it came to light that they were interested in the link between dispute resolution and coaching because they were a career coach. And that was interesting to me because I came to this world from being a mediator and a negotiation trainer. And so when I set up, although I'd been referred, when I sent the email asking for the meeting, I included in that, I used to be a mediator and I use many of my mediation skills as a coach. Would it be helpful if I shared sort of the best practices of that for you? And that was very interesting to her. So again, it became that exchange. So that's one example.
You also have a book coming out next year. It says Own the Job Hunt. What's left to do on the book?
Left to do on the book is we are, to be honest, restructuring it to make it more readable. Our editor loves the content and loves the message, but we want to make it more accessible for the reader. So that's why it's not coming out till the end of next year.
We've had some other authors on who are people at 50 and above trying to change careers, or people that have been downsized and are trying to find a new way to transition their skill sets out, which is kind of why I led with that. And then, of course, the gig economy. It's even getting mentioned by that name on Capitol Hill. And once regulation gets anywhere near it, you know it's already stale. So it's got to be codified at this point, right? So are you trying to address this? And maybe fragmentation is too strong of a word. Maybe it's something else.
What we're giving people is an approach for any of those places they want to be. Be it a more traditional position in a larger company, or it's starting a side hustle, or doing both. the approach we practice, which really, again, the foundation is understanding what's important to the people who are going to be either you're going to be working with or who are going to use that service, that's going to give you the building blocks and the foundation to create something successful instead of either working off half-truths or assumptions and missing the mark.
I do appreciate your time today.
You're welcome, and thank you. This has been fun.
That was Tad Mayer. Tad is president of Career Negotiations. He's also an author. His forthcoming book is Own the Job Hunt. Next up, the Fed. This week, the Fed began to normalize its economic policy. Now, since the financial crisis, the Fed itself has been in crisis mode, pumping billions of dollars into the U.S. economy to keep it afloat at first and then to keep it growing. Now the Fed needs to start selling off some of those billions and trillions of dollars worth of assets that it bought. Here's my chat with friend of the show, Greg McBride. He's the chief financial analyst at Bankrate.com.
Greg McBride, chief financial analyst, Bankrate.com.
Greg McBride, friend of the show, thank you for your time. Help me make sense of what happened at the Fed this week. I read it as a hawkish statement, which means a good sign for the economy, which means a bad sign for easy money. Am I oversimplifying?
No, I think that's a fair statement. When we get together and talk about the Fed, we're usually talking about the Fed raising short-term interest rates. They didn't do that this time, but still did take some action. And something I think that's fairly significant, they announced that they're going to start this process of downsizing that gargantuan bond portfolio that they accumulated in the years since the financial crisis. And in and of itself, this is kind of uncharted territory. So this is something that more directly targets long-term interest rates, things like fixed mortgage rates. You know, as that process goes, they're basically going to be, you know, working both ends of the interest rate spectrum. They expect to continue to raise short-term interest rates, perhaps again as soon as December, while at the same time working down that balance sheet. So they basically have two tools that they're working with at the same time, both of which, to your point, a reflection of the improvement we've seen in the economy.
All right. Well, we have an occasional feature on this show, and I think you've just triggered it, and it's called a teachable moment.
I don't know, a teachable moment.
It could be a teachable moment for them. This
ends up being what's called a teachable moment.
So let's go back and let's talk about the $4.5 trillion balance sheet and how the Fed came to own that much.
So when we had the financial crisis in 2008, the Fed resorted to their usual toolbox of cutting short-term interest rates, and they cut rates all the way to zero by December of 2008. And, you know, as you'll recall, the economy was still sinking fast at that point. So they needed another tool to try to revive the economy, particularly once the economy bottomed and the recovery was really sluggish. You know, they needed something else to work with. And what they started to do was this bond buying program. And so they started to buy up these bonds. They started with government bonds, and then they branched out and included mortgage-backed bonds in an effort to more directly target mortgage rates and bring those rates down. So they accumulated this $4.5 trillion portfolio. And for context, prior to the financial crisis, that portfolio was about $800 billion. So it just shows how much it mushroomed in the years following the financial crisis as they worked to provide some form of stimulus to the economy in the absence of being able to cut interest rates.
Even before the crisis, why does the Fed hang on to an $800 billion balance sheet? What's the value in that?
Well, the Fed is, by definition, they are the lender of last resort. So, you know, that $800 billion portfolio that they had before the financial crisis, that was almost like their checkbook in a way, in the sense that, you know, in the event of market disruptions or some sort of what, you know, at that point, an unforeseen financial crisis, they had, you know, something where they could provide liquidity to markets in the event that markets seized up. Little did we know that that's the scenario that would present itself in 2008, but on a much bigger scale than I think anybody had previously imagined. And that's why when the Fed had to take action, we've seen that balance sheet mushroom in the way that it has.
Okay, so if the economy's not firing, then the Fed is basically the dry powder.
Exactly. You know, they have a portfolio, so it gives them some wherewithal that when markets are tight and they need to put some money into the system, they can do that. If, on the other hand, if we have an economy that's firing on all cylinders and inflation's moving higher, they can also take some money out of the system. They're kind of the, you know, the grease that kind of keeps the wheels moving through thick and thin.
Okay, you mentioned inflation right there. Did Janet Yellen or anybody at the Fed this week talk about inflation specifically?
Yes, it's still below where the Fed's target is. And it, even looking at their economic projections over the next 3 years, they really kind of nudged their forecast for inflation still lower. So I don't see a whole lot of conviction within the Fed that, you know, we're going to see inflation moving up closer to their target. And, you know, their target being 2%. And we've spent much of 2017 moving away from 2% rather than closer to 2%. So I think that really is going to be the wild card as to whether or not they're able to raise rates again in December.
Another macro question for you, Greg. I heard that if the Fed raises rates, then that affects employment. Is that a correlative that we can draw?
In a way, it's not a direct connection, but, you know, what the idea of raising interest rates is that it sort of slows the pace of the economy, keeps it from overheating. The connection that that has to labor is when you raise interest rates, you're raising the cost of capital. So at that point, it becomes a little more expensive for companies to, say, expand production, build that factory, borrow to buy more equipment. And so that's the connection to the labor market. The opposite is also true. So when the economy slows, the Fed cuts interest rates in an effort to make interest rates and borrowing costs lower so that incentivizes that type of borrowing and spending that would, you know, juice the labor market and lead to more hiring.
All right. I guess my last question is kind of a pie in the sky kind of question. And nobody can time the market. Obviously, that's a fool's errand. If the Fed is pushing us back towards normalization by unwinding its balance sheet, by considering at least a December interest rate hike, well, how does the market respond to that? Because it seems like they're taking away the punch bowl.
They are, but it's been, I think, pretty slow. And, you know, we're still at the point where interest rates are low enough that a rate hike is a vote of confidence in the economy. So, I liken it more to taking the foot off the gas pedal more so than pressing the foot on the brake. You know, we'll get to the point where, you know, the Fed, you know, is actively trying to slow the economy. But, you know, with an economy that's growing at more or less 2%, we're not at that point. They're just removing some stimulus. They're not trying to slow things down.
That's a good metaphor. The backing off on the accelerator. You know what I love about the economy and talking about the economy are the aphorisms and the euphemisms we get to use. You know, punch bowl.
We get a lot of mileage out of those, don't we?
Oh, he went there. Greg McBride, thanks a lot for your time.
Always a pleasure.
That was Greg McBride. He's the chief financial analyst at Bankrate.com. For links to Greg's work and all of our sourcing, check out the story that goes with this week's show, It Lives, at KGORadio.com/techonomics. And that's it for another edition of our weekly Biz and Tech Roundup. We hope you enjoyed what you heard, and if so, let's run down how you can find us online. Each segment of Techonomics is a podcast. Normally, we have more interview material than we can broadcast, so the podcasts are the extended versions if you like the topics. You can get said podcasts a few places. There's KGORadio.com/techonomics, or on Stitcher, Audioboom, and iTunes. Just search Techonomics. We are also at Facebook.com/techonomicsradio, and you can follow me on the Twitters. I'm at KGOJason. For producer Liana Wilcox and executive producer Mike Anthony, I'm the writer and host Jason Middleton. This has been Techonomics, and have great weeks, everybody.